So this gives particles with energy that depends linearly on the momentum. So then we discussed how to understand divergences that appear when one calculates the ground state energy of these particles. And basically, this theory contains an intrinsic cutoff on momenta. H bar divided by A, or we can translate this into the cutoff on the energies. So this cutoff arises when we start with the, so our, in the beginning we start with an atomic chain where A was the lattice spacing, and so there obviously the momentum couldn't be larger than the inverse of this lattice spacing. So the calculation of the ground state energy was sensitive to this cutoff. So we had to introduce a quantity that plays the role of the maximal possible energy photon phonon can possibly have. But then imposing consistency conditions that the number of degrees of freedom in microscopic theory and in this continuous description are the same, we were able to determine the cutoff. So this this is called the, this approach is called Debye theory. And so in Debye theory, lambda is equal to six pi squared h bar cubed cs cubed, and then the number density of the atoms to 1/3. And so this is in three dimensions. So then one, by imposing this consistency condition, one can do computations using this simple-minded continuous approach, in principle, beyond the regime where it is valid. So we can, in Debye theory, one can compute say the heat capacity at temperatures which are of order of the lattice scale within certain approximation. But anyway, so so this is this was just an example of a particular effective field theory. So we started with a system that had finite or discrete number of degrees of freedom, and then in the limit it describes it is described by a field theory. So this was basically the introduction, and today I start with the main part of the course, which is relativistic field theory. And so I'll more or less systematically build a theory of relativistic fields. So let me start with just setting up the notations. I assume that you are familiar with the with relativity. I think you had already the course. Right. So here. So anyway, since will be interested in relativistic fields, then they will be defined in Minkowski space. Whose four coordinates are time and space, spatial coordinates. C is the speed of light, as usual. Then an important ingredient of relativity is the interval between two events. So this point in the Minkowski space defines an event, something that happened at a particular moment in time and particular place. And then the interval, say, between two infinitesimally separated events is given by the Minkowski metric contracted with the displacement vector between these two events. So for the Minkowski metric, I'll take the diagonal plus minus 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 matrix. And I guess in general relativity, the signs were opposite. This is, well, somehow it's, the notation tends to stick. So in general relativity and in particle physics, different types of notations became standard. So in quantum field theory, always this metric is used. And in general relativity, the standard choice is plus, minus, plus, plus, plus. OK, so the basic postulate of special relativity is that physics should be invariant under Lorentz transformations, which are linear changes of variables in the Minkowski space. Which preserve the interval. Now, quantities that transform in a regular way under these transformations are vectors, tensors, and scalars. And for them, we will use the Einstein's conventions for summation over repeated indices. And you know that any equation where the indices match is will be automatically Lorentz invariant. So our goal will be to derive Lorentz invariant equations for field theory. And so this is more or less the summary of the notations we will use. And we will also use a special system of units. So I noticed that in one of the problems in statistical physics, you had description of units where everything is dimensionless. So in quantum field theory, one uses something halfway through. So namely, one makes, and this system of units is obtained by setting the speed of light, the Planck constant, and the gravitational constant, or the Newton's constant, to be one. So in quantum field theory, one sets c to be 1 and h bar to be 1. And the mass is still considered a dimensionful quantity. So since c is 1, all velocities are dimensionless. And are all smaller than 1. So the units of length and time become related. And so, for instance, in astronomy, one would measure lengths in light years sometimes. So this is an example of the same sort of units. So measuring lengths in the time units. Mass has the same units as energy, because energy is mc squared, so we set c to 1. Also the momentum has the same units as energy. Okay, so the consequences of h bar being equal to 1 is that these units are related to that. Because, okay, so h bar is the unit of action. This means that Px, or if you wish, one can think of h bar as the right hand side of the uncertainty relationship. So, which is the commutator of P and X. So, therefore, P dot X becomes dimensionless. And E dot T becomes dimensionless. So all basic units are expressed in terms of just one basic unit. And for those, we can consider, for instance, the unit of energy or the unit of mass. So then lengths to the minus 1 has the same units as time to the minus 1, has the same units as energy, has the same units as momentum, and the same units as mass. In particle physics, a convenient unit, or I don't know, traditional unit, is called electron volt. So these are units of energy So by definition, one electron volt is the energy acquired by electron, by one electron when it is when it passes the potential difference of 1 volt. And in this unit, for instance, one can express masses in these units. So for instance, the mass of electron is given by 0.5110 mega electron volts, so 10 to the 6. Mass of the proton is equal to 938.3 mega electron volts, so 2000 times more. And mass of the neutron is 939.6, and so on. So for dimensional counting, it is convenient to remember that there is just one unit, and so all energies and moment are measured in electron volts. Distances and times are measured in inverse electron volts, and so on. Okay, so these were just the preliminaries. Let me now start with the first example of field theory. And this will be the scalar field. So since we want the theory to be invariant under Lorentz transformations, the field itself should be, in general, a tensor. So it should be a vector or a tensor or just a scalar. So the simplest example is when it is a scalar, so it's the same in all the reference frames. And then it depends, well, coordinates in space-time, and satisfies some field equations. Now, what kind of equation can we write for a scalar field? It turns out that there is not so many possibilities. We want these equations to be second order and relativistically invariant. And the only thing one can write from these two derivatives is that one has to take the square of the derivative. So I'll use the notations that d mu is the derivative with respect to x mu. So this is a vector. And to get a scalar, we need to square it. And then we can add an arbitrary constant. So this equation is called Klein-Gordon equation. And the field that satisfies this equation is called the Klein-Gordon field. So what is the meaning of this equation? What kind of physics do we expect to be described by this equation? So first of all, if m is 0, then this is just a wave equation, right? And we know that we already know how to quantize the wave equation. So the only difference would be is that here the speed of sound is replaced by the speed of light, so that the rest would be the same. So it will describe particles which obey the Bose statistics and which have a linear dispersion relation. Now, when we add m, the only thing that changes is the dispersion relation. And it is easy to see how does it change. So let's look for the plane wave solutions of the Klein-Gordon equation. So we substitute e to the ipx for phi. And this is equivalent to saying that p squared minus m squared is equal to 0. But this is the Einstein dispersion relation for a massive particle. So m is basically has the meaning of the particle's mass. So we expect that the Klein-Gordon field describes massive relativistic particles, which obey the Bose statistics. But then to see this explicitly, we need to quantize the honestly quantize the Klein-Gordon equation. So how to do that? Well, we should consider phi as a dynamical variable. So we should say that separate time and space dependence. And regard the spatial coordinate as an index that enumerates various degrees of freedom. And then time dependence is determined by the Klein-Gordon equation. Okay, so this defines some sort of dynamical system that we can quantize. So first of all, we can write down the action principle for the Klein-Gordon equation. So indeed, if we take a variation of this action, then it will vanish precisely when the field satisfies the Klein-Gordon equation. So if you take the variation, this would be equal to d4x delta phi. And then here we will need to integrate by parts. So this would give minus d mu phi, and then minus m squared phi. So the condition that delta s is 0 is the same as the Klein-Gordon equation. So once we have the action, we can, pass to from the Lagrangian formalism to Hamiltonian formalism. Then define canonical variables, impose canonical commutation relations, and then the Hamiltonian will become an operator that we diagonalize and then find its spectrum. So so this is the basic procedure that we want to follow. So first of all, to quantize, of course, we need, and to define Hamiltonian, we need to separate time and space. So here you see that space enumerates possible degrees of freedom, and time dependence is determined by dynamics. Now this immediately, breaks, if you wish, Lorentz invariance. It doesn't break it really, but it the Lorentz invariance is it's not manifest anymore because we chose as time direction as one particular direction, and you know that Lorentz transformations act non-trivial on time. So anyway, but if we want to quantize the field, then we have to do this. So first of all, we can write the action as the integral of the Lagrangian. And then you can see that the Lagrangian itself is an integral over the whole space of the Lagrangian density. So this Lagrangian density is just this expression here. Times a factor of 2, because we should include 1/2 in the definition. So this L, curly L, is the Lagrangian density. And this is a very important property of field theory that we want always to preserve, is that the action is written as a four-dimensional integral, and therefore the Lagrangian is always an integral over some density. So this leads to certain important consequences known as locality. So relativistic fields are always local. So all the terms that we can write in the Lagrangian have the form of the integrals over something that depends only on one point in space-time. Okay, so then for the Lagrangian, we can write the following expression. So I just separated time and spatial derivatives. But then you see that this is basically the same as, first we need, this is very similar to the case we already considered of the quantization of the wave equation. But first we need to pass to the Hamiltonian formalism. So first we define canonical momentum. As usual, this is the derivative of the Lagrangian with respect to the time derivative of the field, with respect to the velocity. And this is just equal to the velocity. And then the Hamiltonian is d3x pi phi dot minus L. Then we should set phi dot to be equal to pi. So this is equal to integral d3x one half pi squared plus 1/2 gradient phi squared plus 1/2 m squared phi squared. So the Lagrangian, so one can immediately understand that this is kinetic, the kinetic energy of the field, and this is the potential energy. Okay, so this the Lagrangian has the form kinetic energy minus potential energy. Yes? So this follows from the formula for the action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so why is that? Where is that?
Oh, because it it reproduces the Klein-Gordon equation as the equation of motion. So the variation
so
of the
start action. From okay.
So but yes, you're right. So we should
Klein-Gordon equation from that.
We should have started with the action,
right,
and then derive the Klein-Gordon equation.
So in that case, where would the action come from? Like, why is the form? Why does it have the form that?
This is just one possible action that you can consider.
Quadratic in the field, and which is Lorentz invariant.
So
it's really scalar.
Yeah.
So yeah. So indeed. Yes. So
it seems like the potential is so it's a quadratic potential.
Yes.
Pretty much. So it's simple harmonic oscillator in a way.
Yes, absolutely true. That's right.
Okay,
so this is a set of oscillators.
Yeah.
Indeed, one can ask the question, what else can we add to this section without adding higher derivatives? So we don't want the equations of motion to be higher than second order. So the action should be quadratic in derivatives.
So we cannot add anything to the kinetic term. So the only terms that we could add are higher powers of phi. So and later we will see that these terms are responsible for interactions between particles. So the Klein-Gordon action describes free particles, and if we add terms higher than quadratic, then they will be describe interactions. Just like in the non-relativistic second quantized Hamiltonian. Anyway, so this Hamiltonian is basically the same as the Hamiltonian for phonons, except that for this term.
Well, I have a question.
Yes.
Shouldn't it be Curly L, I mean, in the definition of pi x, pi x?
No, this should be the straight L.
No, up there.
Up there.
Second line.
Yeah. Oh. I mean, if we... replace L by curly L, we would end up the same.
Well,
it would be curly L if it's partial.
First of all, this should be the straight L, right? So one should understand this integration is analog of summation over indices. So X is an index that enumerates degrees of freedom. So this is the sum over all possible degrees of freedom. Then pi has x as an index, it's a partial derivative. It's an analog of partial derivative of the Lagrangian. And so this is pi dot phi with the indices summed, right? And instead of summation, we should write the integral. So then we can almost immediately write down the answer for the spectrum of this Hamiltonian just by recycling the results that we already have for phonons. But before doing that, let me take a break and discuss a little bit conservation laws. In quantum field theory, but also in general. So, of course, the Hamiltonian is the total energy stored in the field, and it should not depend on time, so it should be conserved. And in principle, one can check this by an explicit calculation. So take the time derivative of this expression, then use Klein-Gordon equation, and at the end one should get zero. Now, if you do this exercise, it is kind of lengthy, so it takes a little bit of time to do this calculation.
just because here you see that we separated this Hamiltonian is not manifestly relativistically invariant. So in particular, to check that it's conserved, we need to write the Klein-Gordon equation in this separated form where we time derivatives and spatial derivatives are separated. This makes things more complicated. So we would like to be able to understand the conservation of energy in the relativistically invariant way. So without losing manifest relativistic invariance at any step of the calculation. And it is possible to do this. Moreover, one can reformulate conservation law of anything in a relativistically invariant form. So this is not always emphasized, but conservation laws are automatically relativistically invariant. So conservation of anything, like, I don't know, conservation of chairs in this room is relativistically invariant. So let's try to see this. So let's introduce the density of the conserved charge. So this would be the number of chairs divided by the volume of the room, and the density of flux. Of this conserved charge. So this would be, for instance, the only way that chairs can appear or disappear from the room is that someone brings them through the door. So this would be the number of chairs passing through the door in the unit of time and divided by the area of the door. And then we can formulate the conservation condition as an equation on the, integral over the density. If this is the room, so if the influx of chairs is described by this vector, and so this is the unit normal to the door, then the total change of the number of chairs in unit time will be equal to, minus the influx. So this would be in principle, we should integrate over the whole boundary of the room. And then we should take multiply by the area of the door and times the projection of the flux on the outer unit normal. So this is simply tells us that the chairs can only appear through the door, and the number of them inside the room is equal to the number that passed through the door. Then we can integrate. So we can use the Gauss law and write this surface integral as a volume integral.
So the volume, the Gauss theorem tells us that when we integrate by parts, so this this would be equal of the volume integral of the divergence of the flux, right? So this means that the integral of this quantity is equal to zero. But if you think in the more general terms, then we didn't make any assumptions about the volume over which we integrate. And therefore, the only way this equality can hold is that the integrand is zero. And then we find that the conservation law is equivalent to a differential equation that d rho over dt plus a gradient plus a divergence of the flux should be equal to zero. So this is, in hydrodynamics, this is called the continuity equation. But now, my claim is that the continuity equation is relativistically invariant. To see this, we can introduce just combine flux and density into a single four vector. So this four vector is called the current four vector. Or simply the current. And then the continuity equation is the statement that the four divergence of the current is equal to zero. So which is manifestly relativistically invariant. Now, of course, one may wonder why do we did this? Why do we put the density and the flux of charge into the same four vector? And I mean, is it guaranteed that they really transform as a four vector? Well, in fact, one can explicitly show that they indeed transform in the correct way. So suppose that we have a so let's use this hydrodynamic analogy. Suppose that we have some fluid whose local density is rho and which is flowing with velocity v such that the flux is equal to j. And so we can concentrate on a small volume element of this fluid, which will move along the flux. And so let's say that during the time interval delta t, it will shift by delta x. So then the density is the amount of charge enclosed in this volume. And flux is, well, basically the density multiplied by the velocity, right? Yes. Yes. Should be delta v. Okay, so so let me rewrite these equations in the form that makes Lorentz invariance, Lorentz transformation properties of J and rho manifest. So this
this can be written as delta q delta v delta t times delta t. I just multiplied and divided by delta t. Now the claim is that this ratio is Lorentz invariant. Well, the reason is that, okay, delta q is of course the same in all reference frames, like independent of the reference frame, the number of chairs in this room will be the same. So the amount of charge cannot change if we change our coordinate system. However, the volume element and the time interval separately are not Lorentz invariant because the volume undergoes the Lorentz contraction and the time interval undergoes the Lorentz, the dilation of time. But they completely compensate in their product. So the four volume is known to be Lorentz invariant. So this is Lorentz invariant. And then you see that rho is proportional to delta t and j is proportional to delta x with the same coefficient that is the same in, that is invariant. So they transform as the displacement four vector. So that then rho j transform as delta t delta x, which is just delta x mu. So this proves that this is indeed a four vector that transforms correctly under Lorentz transformations. So now I'd like to present you some theorem, which is called Noether theorem and which is extremely important in quantum field theory. So qualitatively, this theorem tells you that symmetries and conservation laws is one and the same thing. So conservation laws are always consequences of symmetries. And if you have something that's conserved, it also means that there is some symmetry behind it. So first, let me formulate what we mean by symmetry. So suppose that we have some field theory that has fields phi I. I can be any index that just enumerates fields. It can be a Lorentz index in a set of Lorentz indices or some other label that just enumerates all possible field components. And then we have a Lagrangian that depends on these fields and also on their first derivatives. So the Klein-Gordon Lagrangian is an example of this, but we can consider much more general case. And then there is an action. By symmetry will mean some transformation of the fields and coordinates that leaves the action invariant. So it doesn't change under transformations of the fields. An obvious example is Lorentz symmetry. Or even there is a simpler symmetry in the Klein-Gordon theory, and this is the symmetry under translation. So let's just consider this as a simplest example. So obviously, Klein-Gordon equations are invariant under translations, and the action is invariant. So we can change so we can change x mu to x mu minus a mu, where a mu is a given constant for vector. And then if you accordingly change the fields, so the only change is just the argument of the field, then the action will remain intact. Okay? So in a sense, this is just a way of parameterizing how we parameterize our space-time. So there is some field configuration, right? And we just shift along this field configuration our coordinate system. So the field configuration itself hadn't changed, but we need to offset this by, you know, measuring in the new coordinates. We should measure field in a different point, numerically different. In the Dönthoff theorem, it is convenient to write an infinitesimal form of transformations. So the theorem is formulated in terms of infinitesimal transformation. So infinitesimal form means that we take A to be arbitrarily small and just Taylor expand on it. And then we say that, so this means that we take A mu, and then let's introduce a new letter for it, just to emphasize that it is very small. And then we can say that x changes by minus epsilon, and phi changes by epsilon mu d mu phi, right? So this is just a variation of this transformation to the first order in A. Right? So I say that A is equal to epsilon, and that Taylor expands. So another example is Lorentz invariance. Again, we take the Klein-Gordon field as an example. So Lorentz invariance means that we can do a Lorentz transformation on the coordinates. And then the field by itself, it is a Lorentz scalar. So its value really doesn't change it when we do the transformation. But because we rotate our coordinate system, point at which field had some particular value had, will be sitting at different position in the new coordinate system. So phi changes by the inverse transformation applied to its argument. So what is the infinitesimal form of this transformation? Well, we should take lambda to be in some sense small. So we should take a Lorentz transformation which rotates the coordinate system by through a very small angle, or makes a very, boost the coordinate system with a very small velocity. So we should expand lambda mu nu as delta mu nu. This is no transformation at all. So x goes to x. And then plus some small parameter omega mu nu. So this is infinitesimally small. But then this omega is not arbitrary because lambda was not arbitrary. The condition for the transformation to be a Lorentz transformation is that it should preserve the metric. So let's see how. So this is the condition that the new metric, okay? So the new metric in the coordinate system should be the transformation of the old metric on the other hand, on the one hand, lambda mu rho nu g lambda rho. Right, so this is the transformation of the, I mean, the right-hand side is the result of the transformation applied to the metric as a tensor, but it should be the same in all reference frames. So this g on the left-hand side and then the right-hand side is the same. So then we substitute this infinitesimal form to the both sides of the equation. This would be delta lambda mu plus omega lambda mu lambda delta rho nu plus omega rho nu g lambda rho. And this we can write as g mu nu. So we should keep only the linear term for the infinitesimal transformation. So the zeroth order term is g mu nu, and then plus omega lambda mu g lambda rho plus omega this should be mu. Should be nu. This is omega rho nu g mu rho. Okay, I think I didn't make any mistakes with indices. And so this should be zero. So we can, so what this means is that, I mean, if we take some expression with indices and apply a metric to it, then we just lower the index. So this equation tells us is that omega nu mu plus omega mu nu is equal to zero. So the parameters, the infinitesimal parameters of the Lorentz transformations are antisymmetric matrices with two indices. So strictly speaking, they become antisymmetric if you lower one index. Okay? So in the transformation itself, we have omega with one upper and lower index, and then it becomes antisymmetric when the indices are the same. Okay, so then we can write the infinitesimal form of the Lorentz transformation. So delta x mu is equal to omega mu nu x nu, and delta phi is equal to So what we do is we expand this in in omega, and lambda minus one is basically delta minus omega. So what we get is minus omega mu nu, and then x nu d mu phi, right? Or we can write this as minus omega mu nu x nu d mu phi. And here it's convenient to recall that omega was antisymmetric. So we can actually antisymmetrize indices and write this as 1/2 omega mu nu d mu x mu d nu minus x nu d mu acting on phi. Well, for some reasons, this form will be more convenient. So let me give you a third example. And so this will be invariance under phase transformations of non-relativistic second quantized field. So if you take the second quantized Hamiltonian that we derived in the first lecture, then in each term, there is an equal number of psi's and psi daggers. So if we change a phase of the psi, then the Hamiltonian will not change. So it is invariant under phase rotations of psi. This is also a symmetry. And we can also write it in the infinitesimal form. So delta psi will be equal to I alpha psi. And delta psi dagger will be equal to minus I alpha psi dagger. So now, in general, we may have some symmetry that have several parameters and which acts both on coordinates and on the fields in some as a certain linear transformation. So general form of infinitesimal symmetry transformations is following. So there might be a number of parameters epsilon a. So these are the parameters of transformation. And a, well, there can be n of them, an arbitrary number of them. And then delta x is equal to epsilon a, and then some function of x. right? So you see that here delta x doesn't change. Here delta x is equal to parameter contracted in a certain way with x itself. So in this case, epsilon is omega, and theta is basically x. Here, theta is constant, and well, epsilon is epsilon. So anyway, there is some vector field that determines the transformation of x. So this vector field, or set of vector fields, are called Killing vectors. So last time someone asked, why are they called Killing vectors? And I had a hard time explaining that they're not killing anyone, that the name just comes from them. German mathematician who studied symmetries, and he introduced the notion of the vector field that associated with this some symmetry. Okay, then the fields. Also should transform linearly. And the most general expression that we can write is this one, where L, J, I, A, in general, are differential operators. Which are called generators of the symmetry. So now let's go through these examples and see what are the killing vectors and what are the generators. So first, let's consider translations. And for translations, obviously, the killing vector, so epsilon has an index, right? So this is should be considered as the A index of the transformation. So it labels all possible directions in which we can make a translation. So it plays the analog of this index A that enumerates various parameters. And then delta x is it's written over there. So you see that it's equal to minus epsilon, meaning that theta mu theta mu nu is equal to minus delta mu nu. So here the origin of these two indices is different. So this is a vector index that is a vector index of the enumerating components of the Killing vector, and this is an analogous to A. So it parameterizes possible transformations that are allowed. The generator of Lorentz transformations has one index, right? So it acts on the fields. So indices I and j are absent here. We have only one field. So it has only one index that is analogous to the to A. And so this is equal to d mu. And for Lorentz transformations, theta let's see, so it has one index that is the vector index of the Killing vector, and then two indices that enumerate that enumerate possible transformations. And let me write them both as lower indices. So this is equal to one half delta, let's see. Delta mu lambda x x nu minus delta mu nu x lambda. So you can see that after contracting this with omega lambda nu and raising and lowering some indices, you get the same equation as over there. Okay, one has to use the symmetry, the anti-symmetry of omega lambda nu in these two indices. And L lambda nu is equal to one half x lambda d nu minus x nu d lambda. So this is the first non-trivial case where the Killing vectors depend on position in space-time. So the generator also depends on x and also on the derivatives. And then we can also consider phase transformations. So for them, theta, well, there is no A index, so theta mu is equal to 0. And then the generator is simply equal to I. It's a very simple transformation.
right? Okay, so do you have any questions? Then if not, I will stop here. Oh, yes.
How did you define the parameter epsilon?
Epsilon is epsilon. It should have upper indices, lambda mu, is by definition omega lambda mu. So to compare it with the formulas upstairs, we should substitute epsilon equal to omega. Okay, so let me finish here.